I want to take up in volume 4 in January the 25th, 1902. Here we're talking about the fever of love. Now, I've told you many times that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. And Louisa says, this morning after I went through much hardship, my adorable Jesus came, and as soon as I saw him, I said to him, my beloved good, I can bear no more. Take me with you to heaven once and for all, or remain forever with me on this earth. Louisa has reached such a fever pitch of love that she cannot tolerate not being with the Lord all the time in complete union. And Jesus said, let me observe a little bit where the fever of love has reached. In fact, just as with a natural fever, when the natural fever reaches a high degree, it has the power of consuming the body and making it die. Now, in the same way, the fever of love, if it reaches an extremely high degree, has the power of melting the body and making the soul take flight into heaven. That's what happened to our Blessed Mother in her passing, that the fever of love reached the point where her soul just simply left her body and went off to God. And in her case, of course, the body followed later. And while saying this, Jesus took my heart in his hands as though to visit it and continued, my daughter, the intensity of the fever of love has not reached that point. It takes a little more. Now, this is only 1902 and she doesn't die until 1947, which is quite a long time. And then he made the act of wanting to pour his bitterness into me, Louisa said. But I did not say anything to him. And he, almost reproaching me, added nicely, don't you know your duty? That the first thing that you should do on seeing me is to check whether there is something in me that afflicts me and embitters me, and to pray me to pour it into you. This is true love. Now, you see, the reason why Louisa is being reluctant here is that she wants to die and go to heaven. She doesn't want any more of this stuff on the earth. And he says, no, no, no. This is true love, he says, to suffer the pains of the beloved so as to be able to see the loved one fully content. And then Louisa said, feeling ashamed, I said, OK, Lord, pour. So I want to give you 1 Peter 4:13. I want to give you Philippians 3:10 and Hebrews 2:10. You can look them up yourselves. Now, for January the 26th, 1902, we have a revelation about Blessed Mother. This morning, as I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I saw an endless light before me. Now, that is the endless light of God and also the divine will. I want to give you 1 Timothy 6:15 to 16. That he lives in inaccessible light. And Louisa said, I understood that that light, in that light dwelled the most blessed Trinity. Instead of saying that the light was him. I also saw the Queen Mother before that light. She was all absorbed in the most blessed Trinity, and she absorbed all three divine persons within herself in such a way as to be enriched with the three prerogatives of the Most Holy Trinity, which are power, wisdom, and love. Power is the Father, wisdom the Son, and love is the Holy Spirit. And just as God loves mankind as part of himself, and as a particle that came out of him, and he ardently desires that this part of him return into himself, so does the Queen Mother. In participating in this, she loves mankind with a passionate love as well. Now, on understanding this, Louisa said, I saw the confessor and I prayed the Most Holy Virgin to intercede with the Most Blessed Trinity for him. She bowed, taking my prayer to the throne of God, and I saw that from the divine throne a flow of light came out and covered the confessor completely, and then I found myself inside of myself. You see, we can only give what we have. And if God is light, what will go out from him is light. If God is love, what goes out of him is love. If God is wisdom, what goes out of him is wisdom. We share, we participate in his divine nature. So February the 3rd, 1902, Louisa offers her life so that the law of divorce won't pass. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself with the adorable baby Jesus in my arms. Now, this is volume 4, in case you have forgotten. Back in volume 2, Jesus told her that he wanted her to be another mother for him on the earth. And so when he comes to her as an infant, she's in that mother role. The strange thing is that while he approaches her as an infant, he actually deals with her and speaks to her as an adult. First, he poured a little bit of what embittered him, Louisa says, and then he made the act of wanting to go. But I, clasping him with my arms, said to him, my pretty little one, life of my life, what are you doing? You want to go? And what shall I do? Don't you see that when I am without you, it's a continuous dying for me? Besides, your heart, which is goodness itself, will not have the courage to do it. And anyway, I won't let you go. That's the Song of Songs, chapter 3, verse 4. And also John, chapter 20, verses 16 to 17. The first, the Song of Songs one, is the bride clinging to her bridegroom when she finds him. And John 20 is Mary of Magdala clinging to her bridegroom when she finds him. And Louisa says, I clasped him tightly as if my arms had become chains. Unable to free himself, he remained with me taciturn. And I, seeing the evils of society rage more, said to him, my sweet good, tell me, what will happen if this divorce that they're talking about will come about? Will they come to make this evil law or not? And Jesus said, my daughter, the interior of man contains a gangrenous tumour. That's our rebellion against the divine will. It's filled with rot. That's all the sinfulness. As if it had reached the point of suppuration flowing out. And unable to contain it within itself any longer, it wants to cut this tumour, but not to be cured. Rather, to let this part of the rot out so as to contaminate and infect the whole of society. So the rebellion that's in human hearts, if they make this law of divorce, then they will spread this rebellion to everybody else. Unfortunately, in our age, it has happened. And even more unfortunately, we have recently agreed by an absolutely outlandish majority that people should be able to separate easily without having to wait. But the divine son, almost swimming in the midst of society, Jesus said, cries out continuously saying, O man, don't you remember from what fount of purity you came from? Oh dear. With what hour of light I called you back to our path. So let's go to the fount of purity you came from. In Isaiah 51, verses 1 to 2, Isaiah cries out to a people who are in rebellion against God's will in his day. Remember the rock you were hewn from, he said. Remember Abraham. Remember the man who really loved God to the point that he would sacrifice his own son and therefore sacrifice his own heart to God. And if we were translating this into Irish, we'd have to say, remember Patrick. Remember the one who founded your religion in this country, the one who gave you the faith. Remember him. Remember the life that he lived. It's not this sinful, rebellious life that Patrick ever introduced to us. Not at all. And then Jesus said, would you ever remember the hour of light with which I brought you back to your path? And that is the incredible grace of redemption. How can this be? You've not only contaminated yourself, but you want to reach the point of acting even against your own nature. Now in the 21st century, we've gone much, much further than that. Almost, he said, wanting to give another form to the nature I gave you and the way that was established by me. Well, in the age of LGBTQ, we've done that. Then Jesus said many other things which I am unable to say, and he spoke with such bitterness that, unable to endure seeing him that way, I said, Lord, let us withdraw. Don't you see how men embitter you and almost give you no peace? So we withdrew inside of my bed, and wanting to cheer my good Jesus, I said to him, since you would be so afflicted if men should do this, I offer you my life to suffer any pain in order to obtain that they do not come to take this law of divorce and make it real. And so that my offering may not be rejected in any way, I unite it with your sacrifice, Louisa said, in order to obtain the deed of grace with certainty. While I was saying this, it seemed that our Lord was using my offering to present it before divine justice. He disappeared and I found myself inside of myself. But it seems that at any cost, men want to confirm at least a few articles of this law, since they're unable to confirm it completely and get what they want. In other words, if they get a wedge into the law with regard to this, of course, they will open a major stream and divorce will come. We'll hear more about this in the messages that come now. So February the 8th, 1902, Jesus speaks about the different meanings for his passion. And he talks about the power of victim souls. This morning on coming, my adorable Jesus shared with me part of his passion. Now, while I was suffering, in order to cheer me, the Lord told me, my daughter, the first meaning of the passion contains glory, praise, honour, thanksgiving and reparation for the divinity. So notice the priority that Jesus had, glory and praise to God first. The second was the salvation of souls and all the graces that are needed to obtain this purpose. So if one participates in the pains of my passion, her life contains the very meaning, these very meanings within it. In other words, the victim soul participating in the passion has these meanings given to it as well. Not only this, but she takes the same form or aspect of my humanity. And since my humanity is united with the divinity, the soul who participates in my pain is also in contact with the divinity and can obtain whatever she wants. More so, her pains are like keys to open the divine treasures. So for someone who's a victim soul, this is an incredible piece of information. For the rest of us, it tells us just how high the Lord raises them. So her pains are like keys to open the divine treasures. And this for as long as she lives as a pilgrim soul on the earth. And then there is a distinct glory reserved for her in heaven, which is given to her by my humanity and divinity, in such a way that she resembles my very own light and glory, as well as a more special glory for the whole celestial court, which will be given to it through this soul by means of that which I have communicated to her. So the victim soul not only does an incredible thing for humanity on the earth in the intercession and reparation and all the rest of it, but the victim soul has the key to open the divine treasures. And there is a very special place in heaven reserved for this type of person. And the soul not only gives much glory to God and does an extraordinary amount for humanity, but the blessed in heaven also benefit from her. In fact, the more the souls have become like me in the pains, the more light and glory will come out from with. The more light and glory will come out from within the divinity. And here is how the whole celestial court participates in this glory. And then Louisa says, may the Lord be blessed forever. So February the 9th, 1902, Jesus places himself at the disposal of the soul. This morning on coming, my most sweet Jesus shared his pains with me in abundance, so much so that I felt as if I were about to die. Now, while I was feeling myself in this state, blessed Jesus moved and touched and seeing me suffer, placed himself in my interior and folding his arms said to me, now in my interior, I want to give you Luke 17:21, the kingdom of God is within you. And I want to give you 1 Corinthians 3:16. Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and the Spirit of God dwells in you? So he said, my daughter, just as you have been at my disposal in suffering, so I want to place myself at your disposal to repay you. Tell me, what do you want me to do? I'm ready to do what you want. This is the extraordinary thing expressed in John 14:20-21. You in me and I in you, both completely one. So this is the reciprocal part of this incredible love relationship. So he asks her, what does she want? And he says, I am ready to do whatever you want. And then Louisa said, remembering how grieved he would be if they should confirm this law of divorce, as well as the evils that would come upon society, I said to him, my sweet good, since you deign to place yourself at my disposal, I want you to operate a prodigy of your omnipotence. Now she's praying according to the divine will, because Jesus said that God never, ever wanted divorce. I want you to operate a prodigy of your omnipotence, that the will of human beings be chained so that they may not be able to confirm this law. The Lord seemed to accept my proposal, she said, and said, almost all the victims who have been on the earth, that's the victim souls who have been on the earth and who are now in heaven, have some most refulgent stars in their crowns that allow them to be distinguished well from one another. And he said, these stars are nothing other than some great glory which they have procured for God, as well as a great good for humanity through them. He said, you want me to operate a prodigy so that this divorce may not be confirmed. Otherwise, this may not happen. Well then, he said, for love of you, I will make this prodigy. And this will be the most refulgent star that will shine in your crown. That is, having prevented my justice through your sufferings and after so many wicked deeds they commit, from also permitting this evil in these times. Now notice, unfortunately, in these times, okay? Because that's 1902, in these sad times. But of course, we're living in the 21st century and the law of divorce has become perfectly normal everywhere. Because evil doesn't stop. And you may be able to block it for a while, but they will keep going and they will keep persevering. So, February the 17th, 1902. Jesus explains what death is. This morning, after much waiting, finally I found my most sweet Jesus, and lamenting to him, I said, my beloved good, how can you make me wait so long? Do you perhaps not know that without you I cannot live? And my soul experiences a continuous dying. So here you're talking about this supreme love that's going on in her for him. And it's expressed in Psalm 63. O God, you are my God, for you I long, for you my soul is thirsting. And then it goes on to say, even my body pines for you like a dry, weary land without water. Psalm 63 expresses it quite well. And she said, do you perhaps not know that without you I cannot live and that my soul experiences a continuous dying? And Jesus said, my beloved, every time you look for me, you dispose yourself to dying. Because in truth, what is death if not stable and permanent union with me? For the good, of course. Such was my life, a continuous dying for love of you. And this continuous death was the preparation for the great sacrifice of dying on the cross for you. Know that one who lives in my humanity and nourishes himself from my works, the works of my humanity, forms of himself a great tree. Now, the great tree is one of the marvelous images in scripture. And you'll find it, for example, in Psalm 1, that the good person is like a tree that's planted by the water streams and therefore has a plentiful supply of water. Water in the scriptures is a symbol of divine grace. And so with this plentiful supply of divine grace, then it will produce its fruits. But the wicked are not like that. There are many other references, but I'll just leave you with that one. And Jesus himself, of course, became the tree of life for us. So know that one who lives in my humanity and nourishes himself from the works of my humanity forms of himself a great tree filled with abundant flowers and fruits. Now, the fruits of the Spirit are Galatians 5:22. And I also want to give you Revelation 22:2. So filled with abundant flowers and fruits, which form the nourishment of God and of the soul. For one who lives outside of my humanity, then his works are odious to God and unfruitful for himself. Now, the very clear way that the Lord gives you the on and off picture, the in and out picture, he puts you in a position of realizing, I don't have a choice here. I either have to be in the will of God or else I'm in disaster. So he actually, by explaining it this way, giving us the dark and the light, the good and the evil all the time, that he enables us to actually take decisions that we might wait too much time to make otherwise. So I want to go into February the 19th, 1902. The soul is like a canvas which receives the portrait of the divine image. So I want to give you Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art created in Christ Jesus there. So as I was in my usual state, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus made himself seen in my interior. Now, I want to keep up this thing. Seen in your interior is Luke 17:21 and 1 Corinthians 3:16. He was sleeping. So I want to give you Mark 4:38, Jesus asleep in the boat and the apostles woke him up to get him to do what was necessary. So he was sleeping, spreading many rays of golden light from himself. I was content to see him, but also discontent for not being able to hear the sweet gentleness of his creative voice. Then after much waiting, he returned to let himself be seen. And seeing my discontent, he said to me, my daughter, in my public ministry, the use of my voice is necessary so as to make myself understood. But in my private ministry, my presence alone is enough for everything. That's a very wonderful statement and very, very important. The Lord has to have his message proclaimed to the whole earth, otherwise they'll never hear it. But in the individual relationship with us, This profound silence of adoration and praise and union in the depths of our being, that's it. You don't need words. In fact, words interfere. He said, in my private ministry, my presence alone is enough for everything. In fact, seeing me and understanding the harmony of my virtues in order to copy them within oneself is all the same. So the attention of the soul must be on seeing me and on conforming to the interior operations of the word in everything. Philippians 1:6, the Lord wants to complete the work that he has begun in us. And you know already, this is the middle of volume 4, that the Lord is continuously working within us to perfect what he wants to do. So he said, the attention of the soul must be on seeing me and on conforming to the interior operations of the word in everything. Because when I draw the soul to myself, it can be said that at least for the time in which I keep her in my presence, she lives a divine life. Absolutely fantastic. We're participators, partakers in the divine nature, as St. Peter says in his letters. My light is like the brush with which to paint. That's your Ephesians 2:10. My virtues provide the different colours. And the soul is like a canvas, receiving the portrait of the divine image, that's Romans 8:29, within herself. So it's like those high bridges you have. The higher they are, the deeper beneath them the pouring rain has to fall. And in the same way, before my presence, the soul puts herself in the place befitting for her, that is, at the bottom, in her nothingness, so much so as to feel herself being destroyed, the self being destroyed. Okay? Because if we don't put the self aside, divine love can't take over. And the divinity pours grace in torrents upon her, but only if she goes into her nothingness. He keeps on telling us that anything material is outside of what he wants to operate with. He wants to operate from nothing. So I want to give you Psalm 36, verse 8. He pours in us the torrents of his delight. My divinity pours grace in torrents upon her and reaches the point of submerging her within itself. That's the divine union. Therefore, she must be content with everything. Content if I speak, content if I don't speak. And while he was saying this, she said, I felt myself as though being submerged in God, like a sponge in water. Okay, and I found myself back in myself. So February the 21st, 1902. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus made himself seen in my interior. There's your Luke 17:21 and 1 Corinthians 3:16. And he was almost in the act of resting. Now notice the word almost. And while he seemed to be resting, it seemed as though he received an offence that he couldn't bear. Now notice the seemed. In other words, it's not completely clear. She's sensing this rather than seeing it clearly. So it seemed as if he received an offence he couldn't bear. And as though waking up, he said to me, my daughter, have patience. Let me pour this bitterness into you, for it gives me no rest. And while saying this, now this is something that's going on the earth in 1902. And a little reminder in case you need a reminder. And that is that in these early years of the 20th century, Marxist atheism and communism, secularism, humanism, rationalism, modernism, and a lot of other stuff was being poured onto the earth in like a tsunami. And this was the time of great crisis for the church. This was the time when the church was being sifted like wheat. And we in the 21st century are trying to bear the very bitter fruits that come out of all of this experience that they had in the 20th century. because you remember that Pope Leo XIII had this vision in which Satan asked for 100 years to destroy the church, and he was given permission. Just like Job, Satan asked for permission to test him and try him, and God said yes. This testing and trying is actually very important. Just before his passion, Jesus told Simon Peter, "Simon, Simon," he said, "Satan has asked that all of you be sifted like wheat. But when you recover," he said, "confirm your brethren." And so when you recover means that the Lord knows that we can be very damaged during the actual experience. So it's whatever is going on in 1902 that is causing him great bitterness. So obviously these enemies of the church have made some kind of an inroad that they shouldn't have made. So while saying this, Jesus poured what bittered him into me and assumed his sweet aspect so as to be able to rest. And then he continued to remain in my interior, spreading many rays of light, because that's who he is. You remember the pictures of the Sacred Heart coming from both Margaret Mary Alacoque and Sister Faustina, that these extraordinary rays of light coming from the heart of Christ, the rays of light are coming straight from the divinity. So he was spreading many rays of light in such a way as to form a net of light that caught all men in it. However, some would receive more of this light and some less, according to their dispositions and openness, of course. Now, while I was seeing this, our Lord said to me, "My beloved, when I keep silent, it is a sign that I want to rest." That is, your rest in me and mine in you. And that's Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. When I speak, it's a sign I want active life. That is, I want your help in the work of salvation of souls. Because since they are my images, that's Genesis 1:27 and Romans 8:29. Since they are my images, whatever is done for them, I consider as done for me. Do you remember the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 9, verses 4 to 5, where when Saul was knocked off his horse and he said, "Lord, who are you?" And Jesus said, "I am Jesus, and you are persecuting me." Well, Saul was persecuting Christians. And he came to understand that Jesus identifies with his body, the church. Also, when you look at Matthew 25:40, which is the parable describing the judgment of all souls, that the ones who are lost say, "You did nothing for me. You did not feed the hungry or give something to the thirsty, and you didn't visit the sick, and you didn't visit those in prison," and so on. So, and if you had done it, anything you would do to them, you would do to me. So here's Jesus saying, when I speak, it is a sign I want active life. That is your help in the work of salvation of souls, because since they are my images, whatever is done for them, I consider is done for me. And as he was saying this, he said, Louisa said, "I saw several priests and Jesus, as though lamenting to them, saying, 'My teaching was simple. So much so that both the learned and the most ignorant could understand it, as appears clearly in the gospel. But the preachers of today," that's 1902, "show that they do not draw from it." Sorry, I missed something out there. "But the preachers of these times mix so many loops and quibbles with it that the people remain starved and bored, and it shows that these priests do not draw from the teaching that is in the gospel. They do not draw from the fount of my spring." Isn't that incredible? In other words, they're bringing in all their own theories and their philosophies and their theologies and their this, that and the others, but they're not actually preaching the plain gospel. Unfortunately, that's still going on. Let's come to February the 24th, 1902. And this is about Blessed Mother, Star of the Sea and Star of Light. As I was in my usual state, the Queen Mother came and told me, "My daughter, my sorrows, as the prophet said, were a sea of sorrows." That's Luke chapter 2, verses 34 to 35, and a sword will pierce your own soul. So they were a sea of sorrows, and in heaven they have turned into a sea of glory. Now that's Romans 8:18, that the sufferings of this life cannot be compared with the glory that you will receive in heaven. "Each one of my sorrows," she said, "has borne the fruit of as many treasures of grace. And just as on earth they call me the star of the sea, because I guide them to the harbour of heaven with certainty, in heaven they call me the star of light for all of the blessed. For they are delighted by this light that my sorrows has produced." "In the meantime, my adorable Jesus came," Louisa said, "saying to me, 'My beloved, there's nothing more dear and pleasing to me than an upright heart who loves me and on seeing me suffer, prays me to let it suffer what I suffer.'" So here's the victim soul again, willingly and voluntarily suffering for the sake of relieving the Lord and also saving souls. Jesus said, "This binds me so much and has so much power over my heart that as a recompense, I give that soul all of myself and I concede to it the greatest graces and whatever it wants. And if I did not do so, since I gave myself as a gift, I feel that for as many things as I do not give it, so many thefts I would make from it, that is, I would create debts." In other words, you know, let me just give you an example from Padre Pio. Padre Pio was asked one time, "How is it that the Lord has worked so many miracles through you?" And his answer was, "But I refuse him nothing, and he refuses me nothing." This is this reciprocal giving of this extraordinary relationship of the victim soul with God, and on a lesser level, all of us with him. Afterwards, Jesus transported Louisa outside of herself, and he said, "My daughter, there are certain offences which surpass by far the great offences I suffered in my passion. Today," he said, this is only 1902. "Today," he said, "I've received several of these." Now, what were the Jews trying to do with Jesus in his passion? They were trying to destroy him. They were trying to destroy him as a person in the eyes of the people. They were trying to destroy his reputation as a prophet and as a Messiah and as a healer. And so the more tortures they could give him, the more they wanted the people to say, well, he couldn't be a man of God if he was like this. And so if that's what the Jews were doing in the Passion, on a much greater level, these Marxist atheists and communists and Freemasons and all the others were killing God in the hearts of people and destroying him by the tortures that they were giving to people. "Today I have received several of these," Jesus said, "to the point that if I did not pour part of them out, my justice would force me to send fierce scourges upon the earth. Therefore, let me pour into you." After he poured them, Louisa said, "I don't know how. Hearing him speak about offences, I said to him, 'Lord, what about this law of divorce that they talk about? Is it certain that they won't confirm it?' And Jesus said, 'For now, it's certain.'" Isn't that sad? "For now, it's certain. As for 5, 10 or 20 years from now, if I suspend your state of victim or call you to heaven, they may be able to do it," which they did. "But the prodigy of chaining their will and of confusing them, I have done for now," as he had promised several messages back. "If you knew the rage of the demons and of those who wanted this law, who were certain that they would obtain it, it is so great that if they could, they would destroy any authority that is both church and state. And they would make a slaughter everywhere. So in order to mitigate this rage and to prevent these slaughters in part, do you want to expose yourself to their fury a little bit? And Louisa said, yes, as long as you come with me. So we went to a place where there were demons and people who seemed to be furious, enraged and mad. As soon as they saw me, they ran over me like many wolves and would have beat me. Some would beat me and some would tear my flesh. And they would have wanted to destroy me, but they didn't have the power to do it. That's like Jesus saying to Pilate in John chapter 19, you would have no power over me if it wasn't given to you from above. As for me, however, though I suffered very much, Louisa said, I did not fear them because I had Jesus within me, with me. After this, I found myself inside of myself and filled with all kinds of pains. Now here, Jesus has allowed Louisa to meet the rage that is in the enemies of the church and indeed the enemies of God's people as well. And if you consider the dancing for joy that we saw in Dublin when the abortion law was confirmed, then you see that if they had lost it, that would have been frightful rage against the church. It's very frightening. We're into huge spiritual warfare here. So March the 2nd, 1902, this is the effects of faith. And it's a wonderful, wonderful message. So I have a VIP on it. This morning, Louisa said, I felt all concerned as if the Lord wanted to deprive me again of his presence and therefore take sufferings away from me. And I also felt a little bit of discouragement. Oh, you have to be careful of the negative emotions. The Lord doesn't want them at all because that allows Satan to get a hook into us. Then after much waiting, he came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, one who nourishes himself with faith acquires divine life. And by acquiring divine life, he destroys the human. In other words, you're either going to have the divine life conquering in you or the human conquering in you. Now, the more you feed the divine life, the more the divine life conquers. And what we need is for the divine life to take over completely. So let me read that again. One who nourishes himself with faith acquires divine life. And by acquiring divine life, he destroys the human. That is, he destroys within himself the germs which original sin produced. Now that's concupiscence. And this concupiscence is the thing that draws everybody into sin and the thing that we are fighting all the time. So he says, you destroy within yourself the germs which original sin produced, reacquiring the perfect nature. Now, this is only volume four. And so the Lord is putting in a little seed here that's going to germinate and produce a most wonderful plant later on in higher volumes. And that is, he says that when we eventually arrive at living the divine will, 24/7/365, as distinct from making acts in the divine will, he tells us that each step we take in that direction, each final firm step we take in that direction, Jesus says that each final firm step that we take in that direction is a step into resurrection, final resurrection. It's really incredible that we're experiencing the resurrection in our own lives. But he's only planting a little seed here. So the one who nourishes himself with faith acquires divine life. And by acquiring divine life, he destroys the human. That is, he destroys within himself the germs which original sin produced, reacquiring the perfect nature as it came out of my hands, similar to me. And by this he comes to surpass in nobility even the angelic nature. Okay, so I want to give you Psalm 82, verse 6. You are sons of God. Psalm 8, 5. Lord, you have made us little less than a god, and you've crowned us with glory and honour. John 10, 35, quoting Psalm 86, verse 6, Jesus said, but is it not said in the scriptures, I said you are gods, all of you sons of the Most High. In other words, it's been God's intention all the time to bring us back from this state of disaster as a result of the fall and bring us back to our participation in the divine nature. So March the 3rd, 1902, the chastisements are necessary naturally because of all this frightful spiritual warfare that's going on and the devastating tsunami that the enemies of the church are creating. So I want to give you Amos 3:7. And Isaiah 64:10, the Lord never does anything without telling the prophets ahead of time. As I was in my usual state, Louisa says, my adorable Jesus was not coming. I felt I was dying from his absence. Then around the last hour, moved to compassion for me, he came and kissing me told me, my daughter, it's necessary that sometimes I do not come. Otherwise, how would I give vent to my justice? And men, seeing that I do not chastise them, would do nothing except get worse. Therefore, there will be wars and slaughters necessary. Now, he's giving her her first, she's beginning to see what we call World War One. She saw World War One before it happened. She saw World War Two before it happened. Okay. Because the Lord always shows everything ahead of time. So, in other words, he says there are going to be wars and slaughters. The beginning and the means will be most painful, he said, but the end will be cheerful. That's like saying a doctor tells a patient that you're in a bad way. I have to do this awful operation on you. But when you recover, everything will be fine. Besides, Jesus said, you know that the first thing is resignation to my will. So on March the 5th, 1902, Jesus puts the blame fairly and squarely down to the political and religious leaders. Now, if you go through all the prophets of Israel, they said the same thing. In fact, Isaiah has a very interesting statement. He says that when the leaders take a wrong turning, those who are led are lost. Listen to this. This morning I found myself outside of myself, Louisa said, and after going around in search of my adorable Jesus, I found him. But to my surprise, I saw that he had many thorns stuck in his feet. Now, this is a bit unusual. Under his soles, which gave him pain and prevented him from walking. All afflicted, he threw himself into my arms, almost wanting to find rest and to have those thorns taken out by me. I clasped him to myself and said to him, my sweet love, had you come in the past days, you would not have had so many thorns stuck inside of you. At the most, some would stick and I would have pulled them out at once. This is what you've done by not coming. So who's ticking off who? And while saying this, Louisa said, I kept pulling all those thorns out while blood gushed from his feet and he agonized for the strong pain. After this, as though cheered, he wanted to pour. And then he said to me, my daughter, what corruption is among the people? How crooked are the paths that they follow? So I want to give you Matthew 7, 13 to 14, the broad way that leads to hell and the narrow way that leads to heaven. I want to give you Psalm 1 again, but this time it's the last verse, that the wicked are blown away like chaff because there's just no substance to them. There's no love or anything that would last in them. Crooked. Now, there are many psalms that describe the wicked. And the wicked in the Bible means those who are dedicated against the will of God, which, of course, are like these Marxist atheists and communists and Freemasons and the lot. But he said, Jesus said, it's the bad example of the leaders that has brought this about. When for one who possesses even the slightest authority, a spirit of disinterest must be his light so that he would be distinguished as a leader. And the justice exercised by him should be like a thunderbolt striking the eyes of the bystanders in such a way that they would not be able to move away from his good example. And having said this, he disappeared. I want to give you Isaiah 9:16, that he himself was the great leader. Martha 6:19-02, and this is one of the things you're going to hear now. Sometimes Jesus lets out what he means by saying, I received a terrible blow today. OK, you're going to get it now. This morning, my adorable Jesus, on coming, made himself seen all naked. That's unusual. As though trying to cover himself in my interior, telling me, my daughter, they have stripped me of every principality, every regime, of every sovereignty in order to reacquire those rights of mine over creatures. In other words, they've thrown me out and they want to be God. Isn't that incredible? Of course, in the 21st century that we're living in, God has been expelled from Europe. God has been expelled from America. God has been expelled from Ireland. It's frightening what's going on. And therefore, don't be surprised at all the evils that are happening. Let me read this again. My daughter, they have stripped me of every principality, every country, every regime, every government, every sovereignty, in order to reacquire these rights of mine over creatures. So it is necessary that I strip them and almost destroy them. That's Revelation 11:18. Now, if you look at the condition of Europe after the First and Second World Wars, you know what you mean by almost destroying them. But has it changed anything? And the answer is no. That's the frightening bit. And therefore, if they don't accept the chastisements, the next thing is judgment. Through this almost destroying them, they will recognize where God is not present as principle, as regime, and as sovereign, everything leads to their own destruction and therefore to the fount of all evils. We've already arrived. That in all these countries that I've mentioned where God has been thrown out, nothing but evil is thriving. It's absolutely frightening. So March 7, 1902, before the divine presence, the soul acquires and copies within herself the ways of divine operating. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I saw my loving Jesus for just a little. And he told me, my daughter, when I draw the soul before my presence, she receives the privilege of acquiring and copying within herself the ways of the divine operating in such a way that as she later deals with souls, these souls feel within themselves the strength of this divine operating, which is working in that soul. Okay. Go back to the book of Exodus. And Moses spends 40 days and 40 nights in the presence of God. He comes down with the glory of God all over him. Just by looking at Moses, the people knew that God existed. Simply by looking at Moses, the people knew something about the glory of God. They were looking at a man that was transfigured by the glory of God. When they saw the actions of Moses afterwards in dealing with the evil that they had fallen into, they knew something about the authority and the power of God. Were they able to resist it? Absolutely no. Moses was clothed with the grace, presence, power, wisdom of God. And he also operated the justice of God as well. So the more we plunge ourselves into the divine presence, the more we will come out with his wisdom and all the rest of it. So after this, Louisa said, I felt a fear about whether the things I do in my interior were pleasing to the Lord or not. These are all the acts that she does. And he said, why do you fear when your life is actually grafted onto mine? Now, if you graft one plant onto another, it's all one plant now. And the sap that's going through that plant is all one. Therefore, the life of that plant is all one. So he said, how can you fear when your life has been grafted onto mine? Besides, everything you do in your interior has been infused by me. And many times I myself have done it together with you, suggesting to you how to do it and the way it would be pleasing to me. Jesus is saying, but I'm actually the source of all of this. And I'm the one inspiring you to do this. And when you don't get it, I actually do the praying myself to give you the model. I do everything for you. Other times he said, I've called the angels and united together, they have done what you were doing in your interior. This means that I am pleased with what you do and that I myself have taught you to do. Therefore, continue and persevere. Now, sometimes these queries that Louisa comes up with are actually not from herself. It's the priests who are making these queries and the answers are for us. Louisa didn't need these answers, I think. So we'll give you another one. March the 10th, 1902. The pain of love is more terrible than hell. So I want to give you the Song of Songs 5:6. As I was in my usual state, I felt myself outside of myself, going in search of my adorable Jesus. But I could not find him. I would repeat my searches, my crying, and it was all in vain. Not knowing what else to do, my poor heart agonized and absorbed a pain so sharp that I'm not able to explain it. Now, so for that, I want to give you Psalm 42, verses 1 to 4, and Psalm 63, verses 1 to 2. I can only say that I don't know how I was left alive. While I was in this painful situation, so I suppose I should give you Psalm 22, verse 1. My God, why have you deserted me? While I was in this painful condition, though always in search of him, unable to abstain for one moment from making new searches, finally I found him. A Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. And I said to him, how can you make yourself so cruel with me, Lord? Look a little bit yourself, whether these are pains which I can tolerate. And completely exhausted, I abandoned myself into his arms. So I want to give you Psalm 27, verse 9 there. And abandoning herself in his arms, Psalm 131. And all compassion for me and looking at me, Jesus said, my beloved, my daughter, you are right. Calm yourself, for I am with you and I will not leave you. John 14, 18. Joshua 1:5. Poor daughter, he said, how you suffer. The pain of love is more terrible than hell. That's the Song of Songs, chapter 8, verses 6 to 7. Love is more terrible than Sheol. What is it that tyrannizes one the most, hell or an opposed love, a hated love? Jesus is the one who experienced the opposed love and the hated love. They have hated me without cause, he said. What can tyrannize the soul more than hell? It is a loved love. If you knew how much I suffer in seeing you tyrannized by this love because of me, so as not to make me suffer so much, you would be more calm when I deprive you of my presence. That's the amazing thing, that in all of this terrifying pain, he says to her, do you not realize that I suffer more than you do? So if you realize that, why don't you cool it and just realize that I'm suffering more, that must be a near impossibility. Imagine yourself, he said, if I suffer so much in seeing one suffer who does not love me and offends me, how much more do I suffer in seeing one who loves me suffer? On hearing this, moved, Louisa said, Lord, tell me at least whether you want me to try to go out of this state without waiting for the confessor to come. And he added, no, I do not want you to go out of this state before the confessor comes. Now, Jesus is going to have to repeat this ad nauseam, because Louisa thinks if for an hour or two she has no suffering, then she ought to get up out of the bed and get up and do something decent. And Jesus is continuously telling her that whether she is in the bed suffering or in the bed not suffering, she's still a victim soul. Let me give you a very simple example. If you are married, you are married whether the husband is actually in the house with you at this moment or not. The marriage is a state that you have entered into. And she has entered into the state of victimhood. But this is a recurring problem for her. So Jesus said, leave every fear. I place myself in your interior, holding your hands in mine. So there's your Luke 17, 21 again, and 1 Corinthians 3, 16. And at the contact of my hands, you know that I am with you. So when the yearning for me comes to you, So when the yearning for Jesus comes to me, I feel my hands being clasped by his. And in feeling the divine contact, I calm down and I say, it's true, he's with me. Other times, as the desire to see him becomes more strong, I feel my hands being clasped even more tightly by his. And he says to me, Louisa, my daughter, I'm here. Do not look for me elsewhere. And so it is, she said, I become more calm for another little while. So I'm leaving that there just for the moment.